In 2002, the remains of 11 undocumented immigrants, some from Mexico, some from Central America, were found locked in a rail car in Denison, Iowa. In 2008, 389 immigrants were arrested at an agri-processing plant in Postville. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Those two events put Iowa at the epicenter of the immigration debate for a time, and they are now the subjects of two compelling new documentaries. Train to Nowhere, Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation, was directed by Paul Kakert and written by Colleen Krantz. I'll talk with them about their film and what we can learn from the deaths of the 11 people found in that rail car. And I'll also talk with filmmaker Luis Argueta about his documentary, Abused, the Postville Raid. You're welcome to join the conversation as well after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the next hour, I'll be talking with the filmmakers behind two new documentaries. In about a half an hour, Luis Argueta will be here to talk about his film Abused, the Postville Raid, about the arrest of 389 immigrants at the agri-processing plant in Postville in May of 2008. But first, in 2002, the remains of 11 undocumented immigrants, some from Mexico, some from Central America, were found locked in a rail car in Denison, Iowa. Filmmakers Paul Kakert and Colleen Krantz have turned the investigation into the deaths of those 11 individuals into the new documentary, Train to Nowhere, Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation.
The train crossed into the United States from Mexico on June 15th of 2002. The car arrived in Denison, Iowa on October 15th of 2002, at which time the bodies were discovered the following day.
Some employees thought that they had discovered some bodies in the bottom of a grain car.
The bodies were very badly decomposed. Various stages of decomposition and skeletonization and mummification.
Think about sticking yourself into a 160 degree oven and seal it up.
The cause of death was determined to be hyperthermia and dehydration, and the manner of death was determined to be homicide.
You will sweat. You will drink cold water, you will jump in a cold pool, you'll sprawl out. You know, you do all the things that we can do. Almost none of these options were available to these individuals. You know, if the train had been moving and there had been reasonable ventilation, you know, they might have been able to forestall some of these changes in temperature. But every time that train stopped, it would have just been hellish.
Those are some moments from the new documentary Train to Nowhere, Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation, which will be shown on Iowa Public Television on October 12th at 7 p.m. The film is the result of the work of two Iowa filmmakers. Paul Kakert directed and Colleen Krantz wrote the film. They're both here with me today. Hello, Paul.
Good morning.
Hello, Colleen.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Colleen, I understand that this whole project was really your brainchild. Do you remember when you first heard about those bodies discovered in that rail car in 2002?
Yeah, I was working as a reporter for the Des Moines Register at the time and paid attention when it hit the news. I was not one of the reporters covering it for the Register. I was based in Eastern Iowa at the time. But the story really stuck with me, as it did for a lot of Iowans, I think. And when I decided in 2005 to stay home with my kids, it was it's a story that sort of was still with me, and I felt like I wanted to do something with it, find out more about the people and in the train and the people who investigated.
Why do you think this story struck you so hard? Why did it mean so much to you?
I think it was just this idea of being, you know, this horrific death, of this being trapped in this rail car, probably holding out hope through the whole time they were in there that the smugglers who locked them in there would be showing up to open it as they promised they would. Just this horror of what it would have been like. And also, I want, you know, again, the idea of who was behind the investigation, who were these people that were in there?
When you, in 2005, started to dig into the investigation, what did you find?
I started out, you know, trying to answer some of those questions, maybe through scientists and so on, what would have happened to them in the rail car. But, you know, what it turned out to be was that people would be particularly interested in the characters, as I talked about what I was finding. Whether it was in one case that we focused heavily on a big brother of one of the victims. There was an 18-year-old from Guatemala who died in the rail car, and his big brother was lives in New York, and to me was really interesting, as was an immigration agent who was then based in Omaha. He's interesting in himself, I thought. And that's what I really found, is that maybe the story was based around these people even more than I would have guessed to start with.
Were all the bodies identified? Do we know who all of those people were?
Yeah, they were eventually identified. It took about, it was close to a year, I think, before they had them all identified, because they had to travel to Central America and Mexico and get DNA samples. But ultimately, they were all identified.
Tell me what you know about the journey that these people took. Where did it start?
They all started in, they came from five different countries. So their journeys to start with were not the same. Most of them used smugglers to get through Central America and through Mexico. But once they crossed the Rio Grande in various ways, they were in southern Texas. But what a lot of people don't realize is that there are sort of, you can think of it as a second border in a sense. There's interior checkpoints along the major highways leading out of the border region. And so there's U.S. smugglers who help undocumented immigrants move from that area past the checkpoints. And so that's how this group ended up together. Most of them were in one of two different what they call stash houses, which is basically a place where smugglers, various houses where smugglers keep undocumented immigrants as they're waiting to move them past those checkpoints. So in that point, that's where they ended up together. And their journey from there was, together on the train.
When they got on the train, do you know where they thought they were going?
They were supposed to go from, Harlingen, Texas, which is not far from the border. They were going to try to get past the checkpoint, which is near a small town in Texas called Sarita. And they were supposed to be let out near Kingsville, from our understanding.
So this was supposed to be a very short journey.
Yeah, they said, I think they were told by the smugglers it would be an hour to 2 hours.
When they got on the train, did they have any provisions with them, water, food?
No, we have in the documentary, we talk about how I should explain, first of all, that there was a second rail car full of immigrants on the same train. When Border Patrol did one of their random inspections in that region after the train left Harlingen, they found one rail car full of undocumented immigrants. I think there were 26 in that rail car, but they overlooked the other rail car with the 11 inside. And so that's from that point, they basically had no provisions with them because they had not expected to be in there long. And one of those who was taken out of the rail car of 26 said he even asked about taking water. But the smuggler said, no, don't worry about it. We'll let you out. It's only an hour or so.
Why was this rail car locked?
The smugglers had found or had figured out from understanding how Border Patrol tends to do train inspections that if they would lock the top latch door on these grain hoppers, they would draw less attention. Obviously, there's this tendency to think, why would anyone allow themselves to be locked inside a rail car? So I think Border Patrol inspectors would typically go past those that were locked and, check those that were unlocked.
And, of course, in locking that top door, that closes down pretty much all ventilation in the rail car.
Yeah, there was a few small vents. These cars were designed to carry grain, so there was a little to allow some air to circulate, but they were very small ventilation holes, and you would have had very limited breeze or ventilation.
Well, we'll talk more about what probably happened to those people inside the rail car in a few minutes. But when you first started digging into this investigation, what was your intention? What did you want to do with this information?
It was really important for me, first of all, to make to tell a story. I started it as a book proposal, actually, but we, you know, eventually this shifted to this documentary idea, and later the book, you know, the book deal did come along. But my intention for either format was to tell the story as straightforward as possible. I did not want it to be political. I didn't want people from either side of the immigration debate to feel like we were pushing them one way or the other. I think a lot of people tend to watch documentaries with this sort of anticipation of, you know, I'm waiting to see which way they're pushing me, and if it's not my way, I'm going to turn it off. And so we felt strongly that that this was important to us to make sure people from either side could watch it and then maybe walk away and draw their own conclusions. We didn't want to have some kind of political message hidden in here.
And when the documentary idea came about, that's where you came into the picture, Paul. When did you first start or first hear about this project?
I heard of it through the Iowa Motion Picture Association. Colleen, I believe, was referred to them or contacted them asking for their help. And they put out information that a writer was looking to work with a documentary filmmaker. And I read through it. And I had just about a year ago started an organization called Storytellers International with the sole purpose of finding these types of stories. So I immediately, you know, emailed Colleen and wanted more information. And then the more she described it to me, it just seemed like a perfect fit for the type of films that I wanted to do.
What about this story really struck you and made you want to work on the film?
Well, I vaguely remembered this story from when it happened. You know, I've lived in Iowa my whole life. And as Colleen told me more and more of the details that I either wasn't aware of or didn't remember from 2002, I just saw I saw beyond the immigration headlines and saw a lot of the human drama that was in this story. You know, older brother looking for his younger sibling who he knew came over, and then hearing about this rail car, and then kind of, you know, it clicking that, you know, that must be his brother. And so many stories like that just really pulled me in.
Well, we'll talk more about those individual characters who come out and how you discovered the stories behind the headlines in a few minutes. Colleen Krantz and Paul Kakert are the filmmakers behind the new documentary Train to Nowhere, Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation. The film will be shown on Iowa Public Television coming up on October 12th. And if you remember the incident in Denison, if you have some impressions you'd like to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today I'm talking with the filmmakers behind two new documentaries. In about 15 minutes, I'll be joined by Luis Argueta, who will talk about his film Abused, the Postville Raid, which is about the arrest of 389 immigrants at the agri-processing plant in Postville in May of 2008. But right now, I'm talking with the filmmakers behind a film about another incident that put Iowa really at the epicenter of the immigration debate, and that's when, in 2002, there was a rail car discovered in Denison, Iowa. Inside that rail car were the bodies of 11 undocumented immigrants. Colleen Krantz wrote the documentary, and Paul Kakert was the director of the documentary. They're both with me today. And Colleen, when you started to look for people to really tell this story, you did track down the older brother of one of the people in the rail car. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Yeah, he actually came to the United States illegally also, but way back in the late 70s. And he was the oldest of nine children in this family from rural Guatemala. And the one who died was the youngest. But when he left, his youngest brother, Byron, had not even been born yet. And so he's here in the United States, and he left because, you know, his family, as you can imagine, was struggling. They're farmers in a remote part of Guatemala. And I think as the oldest, he felt like he should drop out of school and try to make a living, and felt like the United States was his way to do that. He had a, you know, had a hard time here at first, but basically over time he started building a career. Basically, he eventually got his green card, and he's a citizen now, and the owner of a very successful landscaping business in New York State. So here's his younger siblings, as you can imagine, seeing all this happen. And Byron, the youngest, was asked by all his siblings to stay on the farm. By this point in 2002, they had all left to their lives, basically. Some had come to the United States, some to other parts of Guatemala. Some were married and just moved to other parts of the area. But basically, there was the siblings were asking him, you know, to stay with mom and dad. They're getting older. They need help on the farm. But what you'll find out in the documentary is he saw this this life his big brother Eliseo had in New York, and he was also a kid who was proud and wanted his own chance to make his own money. At that point, his siblings were even sending him money to when he wanted something, hoping that he would be happy to remain there. But, you know, like a lot of teenagers, he sort of felt the pull to see the world and wanted the pride of making his own money. So that story was really what drew us in.
Of course, when the news came out that there were these bodies in this rail car, nobody knew who was inside. When did Eliseo discover that his brother was one of the people who died in that rail car?
Paul briefly mentioned that. You know, he had 4 months where Byron had basically disappeared. He had a phone call from southern Texas, and that was from his brother and the smugglers who had him. And that was the first he knew that his brother had left Guatemala, because his brother knew the family would not support his decision to leave the farm. So he hears from him once and then basically does not hear from him again. And spends 4 months trying to find out what happened to his brother, and is desperate the whole time. He's searching, making numerous trips to Texas and so on, and so this whole time the older brother Eliseo just has no idea what happened to Byron until he's driving his gravel truck, from his landscaping business one day down the highway in New York, and hears a radio report about 11 bodies being found in Iowa. And as you'll hear him say in the documentary, it just hit him then. He was almost certain that his brother was in that rail car.
How did he find out for sure?
He put some calls into, or he had a friend call authorities. I think he was too shaken up to do it himself, but they got a call to Iowa and talked to some people here that were already on the case, probably within the first day, I think. And, they started comparing the time that they figured out the train had come from Mexico into the United States and the time it had left various areas. And it matched up real closely to the time that his little brother had disappeared. They weren't certain until months later when they got the DNA analysis back that it was Byron. But I think Eliseo knew the whole time that it was very likely, as did the investigators.
I can only imagine, though, that there were probably people who had relatives missing all over the United States, who thought, well, maybe that's my brother, or maybe that's my sister or my uncle, or, I can only imagine there were lots of people who had those same questions.
Yeah, exactly. Investigators said they did have quite a few calls like that, and some of those calls were the first things to get them started on tracking down who was who. There were also some papers and other things in the rail car, but the calls were important, and they did kind of come from all over. And for us, the story, started for people in Iowa, the story started when they found the bodies in Denison. But you have to remember that there was 4 months where the families who were looking for relatives, that's when it started, back in June instead of in October. And there were a lot of families. There was even one gentleman from Mexico who basically retraced the path his stepson had taken, going with the smuggler, the same smuggler his stepson had gone with, hoping to retrace his steps into the United States and find some clues about what had happened to him. But all of them had their own searches happening.
Paul, when you signed on to this project, you were tasked with finding visual images to help tell this story that had happened years before. How did you go about that?
Well, that's probably the most difficult thing that we did have to do. You know, it was so long ago, and there was we did find some news footage, but it was all of, you know, just that one event that day when it happened, and then not much else after that. So we did what we could. We traveled along the border towns of Texas and some of the towns where they were, and were able to get footage of the rail yards there and things like that. But, you know, as it turned out, the characters that, you know, as she mentioned, Eliseo, who is very good about, you know, really opening up to us and letting us follow him along. So we were able to get quite a bit from him, and investigation photos were available. And we actually did partner with a associate producer who was in Guatemala, who was able to get, you know, footage from Central America for us. So it did come together.
Did you spend time in Denison?
We did go to Denison initially to get a few interviews, but didn't spend a lot of time there. You know, really the film starts there. And then, you know, quickly gets into the, you know, the family stories and the people involved. So that's kind of just the launching point for us.
We have a comment on Twitter from Ian who said, I was taking a computer class when they found the train car and my teacher had to go because he was in the fire department in Denison. So it was an event that I'm sure really shook up the people in Denison, which, as you know, is a very small town. Colleen, did you talk to people in Denison about what they experienced?
Yeah, we did. In fact, people in Denison and people across the state really tend to remember this. I think it stood out, of course, to people in Denison the most because they wondered at first, you know, could there be some connection to Denison with someone trying to reach this town, visit a relative or something. But in the end, there was no particular connection except that's where the bodies were found. But we talked to a number of people, at least a few. A retired sheriff's deputy is in the documentary numerous times, and he was very helpful.
You talked to an immigration agent in your research and in the documentary. Why did you choose to talk to him?
He was the key investigator for a large amount of the time during this. I mean, I think most of the time, actually. His name is Alonzo Martinez. He was based in Omaha and sort of had to oversee this whole team. But really what made him interesting to us is just sort of his first of all, he happened to be work for Border Patrol at the time that Eliseo came into the United States illegally back in the 70s. And we found it kind of interesting that through this investigation, basically the two of them become friends. It seems like sort of an unlikely friendship, but they got to know each other well and were close by the end. But Alonzo is also interesting because he's got very strong feelings about strict border control. His vow to, you know, protect the Constitution or to follow the Constitution, he takes that very seriously. But he also is of Mexican descent. His grandparents came to the country, I think, in the 1920s. And in fact, one he believes maybe entered illegally. But it's, you know, he doesn't find that to be a problem with him being a member of the Border Patrol. In the past, you know, he was with INS later, but it was very common for him to encounter people when he would make an arrest. People would say to him, you know, you're one of us. Why are you doing this? And, you know, he says in the documentary, well, you know, he doesn't see himself as being the same. And he doesn't, you know, he doesn't feel like he has a loyalty issue that everyone wants to assume he has.
You mentioned that you worked very hard to keep any kind of point of view out of the film, that you want people to make up their own minds about immigration issues. Was that extremely difficult for you to keep it neutral?
Well, my background is journalism, and that's was always my goal in journalism, and hopefully we succeed when we, you know, when that's our goal. But it is hard, you know. We are storytellers, though, so we, you know, our instinct was to say, let's just let the story tell as straight as we can. And we did ask people, we had a small group of people watch it before, as we're getting to the sort of the final cut, and one of the questions we asked them as they watched it was, did you feel like this was balanced? Did we achieve our goal in not making it feel political to you?
And what did they say?
We had almost universally, they said, you know, you did it. It's balanced. There was one or two things that people said, this, you know, the placement of this, the way this played made me feel differently. This felt like it slipped away a little from journalism. And so in those cases, we talked about it, and we would either, you know, if we felt like it was a valid point, we either would remove or adjust. I think we only had a couple of people say that, but it was a good check on our, you know, our goal of trying to keep it balanced.
Paul, you mentioned that when you first put this trailer up on the web, you found that response on the subject of immigration sort of exploded.
Yeah, I don't think you can get away with, you know, having a title like this and not having people bring in their preconceived notions, you know. And we would get comments. Obviously, people hadn't seen the film, and, you know, comments would come through on a YouTube page or something immediately saying, you know, how could you do a story on this or that? And so, you know, hopefully we can, you know, get the word out and, you know, encourage people to see it and then make up their minds, you know, because we I don't consider it an immigration story. I consider it a crime story, a human drama that just happens to deal with illegal immigration.
Colleen, you said that you did some research into what these people in the train car must have experienced. Can you tell me what the conditions would have been like?
Yeah, we talked to a couple professors at the University of Iowa, and they sort of went through this, the physical and mental, what they would have experienced physically and mentally. And, you know, at first, of course, it's mostly physical. Just with that tremendous heat, they think it maybe was 150 degrees inside this rail car, extremely humid, so much so that the perspiration was dripping from the top of the rail car. People would just be in agony. And eventually it's sort of the mental anxiety would kick in. We think at first they, you know, when the Border Patrol was doing the inspection, they would have been quiet because, you know, they, at that point, you know, they were right nearby. Nobody heard anything. People in the other rail car didn't say anything because they didn't want to give them away. But eventually they would have, you know, I mean, it's just natural instinct. Eventually they would have been screaming for help. The professors tell us they would have, you know, been frantically clawing at the inside, anything they could do to try to escape the rail car.
How long do you think they would have lived?
The medical examiners gave an estimate of perhaps 24 to 36 hours. I think after so much time passed, they didn't have much to work with when looking at the bodies, but that's their, you know, between evidence from the investigation and their own knowledge, they came up with this estimate of 24 to 36 hours.
When people watch this film, what do you want them to take away from it?
You know, we've had people, when we had one of our advanced screenings, someone in, we showed it in Denison first, and somebody asked me that. They said, I'm real sad watching this, and, you know, I don't know, should I be angry? And, you know, what my answer was that we don't want to tell you how to feel. We don't want to make this something pretty when it's not. It's what it is, and I guess we want people to just watch it themselves and maybe gain some insight, whether, you know, whatever that insight would be. There's a lot of, I guess you can say, inside information about what life was like for not only the undocumented immigrants, but also for the INS agent. And so we want people to just, you know, feel their way through it and take away what they want to take away.
What do you think you've taken away from this experience?
I think, for me personally, it's just being, you know, working on a documentary has been a new thing. I've always been a print journalist. And you know, one thing that was interesting to me doing this was the different reaction you'd get if you were when we were in Iowa versus when we were filming in Texas. And I think we forget here how common this is, this kind of, you know, the deaths of undocumented immigrants is not something that some Texans we talked to thought was necessarily newsworthy.
Right, but it certainly was newsworthy in Iowa. Paul, what did you take away from this experience?
Well, my goal with all my films is, you know, you get that opportunity to experience the lives of others that are completely different from yours. And that's where I think this is, you know, aside from all the other issues, if you can watch this with an open mind and consider, you know, the decisions these people make, you know, based on their life circumstances and how different that is from yours, I think that's what I'll, you know, take from this the most, you know, is, you know, those conditions that caused 11 people to make a decision that says, you know, at this point in my life, it's best for me to get locked in a rail car, smuggled into another country, and, you know, risk my life, you know. And so that's, you know, that's what I'll remember most.
Filmmakers Paul Kakerd and Colleen Krantz, they're behind the new documentary Train to Nowhere, Inside an Immigrant Death Investigation. It will be a book in a year or so as well, Colleen, right?
That's right, in April or so.
All right. And the documentary will be shown on Iowa Public Television on October 12th at 7 p.m. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in a moment, I'll talk with Luis Argueta, who will talk about his film, Abused, the Postville Raid, about the arrest of 389 immigrants at the agri-processing plant in Postville in May of 2008. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On May 12, 2008, the Department of Homeland Security Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents raided the agri-processing plant in Postville, Iowa. 389 immigrants, most of them from Guatemala, were arrested. Luis Argueta, a filmmaker from Guatemala, has made a documentary about those raids. It's called Abused, the Postville Raid.
During our May 12th operation at Agri-Processes in Postville, Iowa, ICE agents executed criminal and civil search warrants at the company, resulting in the arrest of 389 undocumented alien workers. ICE is first and foremost a federal law enforcement agency. Our agents and officers performed the mission lawfully, professionally, and compassionately.
We got into the ambulance and we drove up to Agra. All of a sudden, I see lines and rows of Hispanic workers on their knees like dogs, and they were just chained.
These people that were here, they're wonderful workers. All they wanted, the same thing in life you and I wanted, was a better life. And the little kids here are U.S. citizens. What's going to happen? Just all this torment. Devastation and fear. That's what you could call Postville. Devastation and fear.
Those are some of the voices heard in the new documentary, Abused, the Postville Raid. Filmmaker Luis Argueta is with me now. And Luis, you spent a lot of time talking with the people who were there on the day of that raid in Postville. What happened that day from their perspective?
I've been able to reconstruct what happened from the point of view of the people inside the plant, the workers. And they said that they had arrived, many of them, to apply for work again, because they had been fired the week before, which was sort of a normal occurrence. People would get fired and said, come back and reapply with better papers. And they did. And some of them were there waiting to be hired, and they were arrested. Others were working. They had begun working at 7 a.m., and all of a sudden somebody shouted, La Migra, immigration. And people just began running everywhere. They were trying to hide in places where there were chicken feathers. Some people went into the freezer areas. There is a young man who I interviewed in Guatemala who his first instinct, and this was actually confirmed by a phone call he got from a supervisor that was not at the plant. The supervisor said, remember the place where I always told you you could hide. And he went to this place, and he was in the floor, and he would have to hang himself and slide into this space. And all of a sudden, he realized he couldn't hang himself by his hands because he's missing two fingers that he lost while working the plant. So what he did with two other people, he hid inside the area of the cardboard boxes. And he spent the whole day and the whole evening, and about 1 o'clock in the morning, he was able to finally leave the plant. But those that were not so lucky were rounded up. I have women telling me that guns were pointed at them. I have women saying that they were insulted and told not to run. it was just pandemonium.
And some of the people that you talked to talked about people who were arrested being hit or pushed to the ground.
Yes, I have a woman who says that she saw how her co-worker was pulled by the hair and pushed down to the ground.
You also interviewed a woman who worked for a paramedics unit that came to the plant.
There is a teacher at the high school who was also a paramedic. When she heard the helicopters, she went to the window, and almost at the same time, her beeper went off, and she went to the principal and asked permission to leave because she is a paramedic and drives an ambulance. And she describes a very upsetting scenario. She says, I'm paraphrasing her, I saw a line of Hispanic workers underneath chained like dogs. And then she says, I've never seen anything like that.
And she talked about the mood among the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, the ICE agents. What did she say about them?
She says it was they were mocking the people who the man that she was taking to the hospital. So it was a very unglamorous picture of what had happened.
And that day, many people, many mothers who had children with babysitters or in child care were taken into custody without an opportunity to do anything for their children.
Well, initially, everybody was rounded up, and the women were asked if they had children at home. And if they said yes, then they would be separated and put in a different bus. These were secure buses that are what I call moving jails. Later in the day, they would be interviewed again and asked if they had kids at home. And eventually, sometime in the afternoon, they were began to be released one by one after having been outfitted with a ankle monitoring device, a GPS, that would prevent them from working and would prevent them from leaving the area. So that evening, they were able to be reunited with their kids. But in the meantime, they were not able to be in touch. There were two cases of women who, having underage kids, said they didn't because they were afraid. One was a Guatemalan woman, and the other one was a Mexican mother. And they both were afraid because they heard from some of the people at the raid, some of the agents, that if they had kids, they would just go and get them and put them in jail with them. So they believed the rumors, and they said they had no kids. These two women were sent to the National Cattle Congress in Waterloo. They were put through the fast-tracking system and left close to 300 people condemned in 4 days. And these two women went to jail for 5 months. After that, one was deported to Mexico and one was deported to Guatemala.
What happened to the people who were arrested that day? You mentioned those two that went to jail for 5 months and then were deported. Was that what happened to most of the people who were arrested that day?
There were about 48 women and two men that, because they had underage children and said that they had underage children, were released with the ankle monitoring devices. The rest of the people, including underage workers that were at the plant at the time, were bused to the National Cattle Congress in Waterloo, a facility that is usually used as an educational facility. And there they were processed through a fast-track system. At the National Cattle Congress, people were presented with an offer they couldn't refuse. And the offer was either you plead guilty to having used fake papers and take a five-month sentence followed by deportation, or we will charge you with aggravated identity theft, which as of 9/11 or 2001, if you're found guilty of that charge, it carries a minimum sentence of 2 years. Ironically, this statute of aggravated identity theft was in dispute at the time. There was one court that had said, no, you cannot use this statute against undocumented workers that have papers that are not theirs and are looking for work. And two courts had said, yes, you can. Eventually, it came to a tie. Three courts said yes, three courts said no, went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that you cannot use this statute against undocumented workers who use somebody else's Social Security number or fake Social Security numbers to get jobs, unless you know the person. Today, that statute would not have hold water, and these people would not have been able to be threatened with that charge.
You also told the story in your documentary about the people of Postville and how they responded, the other people of Postville, and how they responded to the arrests of so many of the people who lived amongst them. What was the community response like?
It was remarkable. People learn about the raid in different ways. Sister Mary McCauley, who was the pastor of three of the churches in the area, was at her home in about 10 miles east of Postville, and the name of the town escapes me right now. She heard from Paul Ryle, the minister, the Hispanic minister at the church in Postville. He said to her, "Sister, the rumors are no rumors anymore. The helicopters are here." And those are words that I'll always remember because they always told me this is how I learned about it. Everybody else either heard on the radio or just because they were in school, they heard the helicopters. That's the common denominator, the helicopters. A lot of the kids heard about their parents being arrested through relatives because all of a sudden cell phones began to go crazy, and that's how they found out.
A lot of people who have heard about this story, and at the time there was a great deal of debate about it. There were a lot of people who heard about this story and said these were illegal immigrants. These were people who were in the country and working here illegally. Why shouldn't they be arrested? Why shouldn't they be deported? And what's your response to that?
Well, you know, that's not an old argument. That's argument still being put forth today in the case of people who are here with no immigration status. And my answer is yes. If you break a law, you should pay for breaking the law. And all these workers said, you know, we knew that that we had broken the law and were ready to pay, but we were not ready to be treated the way we were treated. And I think that it was not only the workers that were treated in a totally abusive way that day, but the Constitution was abused that day. It was really stretched to the limit, and I think it was a very unconscionable act. This raid cost taxpayers $5.2 million, plus all the expenses of the trial, plus all the expenses of the housing of these immigrants, and the purpose was purely political. This was just to make a point, to make people think that the government is doing something to protect us. Well, this is not protecting us from real criminals. There is a federal judge in Iowa who sentenced 57 of the workers that went to the National Cattle Congress. He says to me, and this is in the documentary, he says, on a busy day, I sentence four people. In a day and a half at the National Cattle Congress, I sentenced 57. And I'm going to paraphrase him, he says, you know what's amazing? Out of these 57, not one of them, not a single one, had even a misdemeanor. And again, paraphrasing him, he says, to have 57 people in federal court that don't even have one misdemeanor among them is incredible. So this tells you what the whole scenario was like.
You follow some of the people who were deported back to Guatemala. What is life for them like today?
If I can backtrack a little bit. I went to Postville on July of 2008 with the plan of being there for 4 days, interviewing a few people, and then doing two, three, 4 minute portraits of undocumented immigrants and put them in a YouTube little series that I was doing. And instead, after 4 days, I told my partner, Vivian Rivas, who had traveled with me, I said, Vivian, I can't leave. I took her to the airport, went back to Postville, stayed another week. And since then, I have been back to Postville 25 times. In one of my early trips, I accompanied five families back to Guatemala, and that was the first of 10 trips in the last 2 years. And these people are now living on dirt floor, tin roof huts. They are back to the conditions that they tried to escape originally. And ironically enough, now there's 14 U.S. citizen children born in Postville living in these conditions in Guatemala. And until the Constitution is changed, these are 14 U.S. citizens who have no access to any of the services that we as citizens expect and deserve.
When you were in Postville, when you went there for 4 days and that was your intention, what was the moment that changed your mind?
I was at the hall of the church on Saturday, July 26th, if I'm correct. And three congressmen had traveled from Washington at their own expense to listen to the testimonies of the people who had survived the raid. And at one point in that room, you could hear a fly. You could only hear whoever was speaking, and at one point, everybody had tears in their eyes. And at that point, I said, this is a story that has to be told. And recently, the Deputy Attorney General of Iowa said, this is a film that every American should see. And I totally believe that, that's why I've dedicated the last 26 months of my life to tell this story.
What do you want people to take away from seeing this film?
What I want people to take from my film is very simple. I want people to say, these are not 12 million faceless illegals. These are human beings like you and me with the same dreams that you and I have, and that they begin to see them not as the other, but as ourselves. This is a mirror. There's a man who I respect very much who says, Postville was a story that tells us this is not about them, this is about us, this is about all of us. And that's what I would like people to realize, that this is not about them, this is about us. This really, hopefully, will open our eyes to the humanity of immigrants and to the inhumanity with which we sometimes treat them.
Luis, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Charity. Thank you.
Luis Argueta is the filmmaker behind Abused, the Postville Raid. He'll be showing his film and talking with the audience tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Iowa State University Memorial Union in Ames. If you'd like to see the trailer for this film or the film we talked about earlier today, Train to Nowhere, you can find links on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt and technical support from Jonathan All in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.